Hello, mead friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Mead Podcast. I'm your host, Brando Tice, and today Frank and I sit down to discuss brewing mead at home. We start off the conversation talking about the basics you need to brew and some of the resources available to home brewers either locally or online. We then review best practices and how one can translate those into their home brewing process. Now let's get into it.
Hey everyone, here at Golden Coast Mead, we consider drinking alcohol not only a luxury, but a celebration of life. If you partake in this celebration, we advocate for drinking regenerative mead made from real honey to help shift the $1.5 trillion alcohol industry in a better direction. When you drink our regenerative mead, you are helping to make the earth healthier, more biodiverse, and abundant. Drop monoculture-based booze and drink regenerative mead. Visit our website, www.goldencoastmead.com, to learn more about our regenerative mead business and be a part of the celebration. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. Good to see you, Brandon.
Good to see you too. Happy midweek.
Thanks. Yeah. 4th of July was a couple days ago and already we're in the middle of summer.
Crazy.
It's beautiful.
What are you drinking?
Wildflower Sour, the new release. Well, it's not quite released yet, soon.
How's it tasting today?
Yum. It's floral. It's honey forward. There's a bit of a tart backbone, less tartness than typical. And that being said, I think it comes together into a floral, delightful, refreshing, clean, delicious experience that I highly recommend.
Yeah. Customers should go check it out on our website, buy a bottle.
And farmers markets and mead shop here in Oceanside, farmers markets throughout San Diego, and then online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Light up your life and your loved one's life.
Amen. So you want to talk about home brewing mead today, huh?
Yes, I do want to talk about home brewing mead and your experiences with brewing at home and maybe some helpful tips for people looking to start brewing mead at home.
Great.
For people who are already brewing.
Yeah.
So I think the basics to start out with are, if you're looking to brew mead at home, what are some like resources people have for honey, yeast, nutrients? Where can people go to start getting the basic ingredients?
Ingredients are very important, right? Starting with quality ingredients means you're going to be much more likely to make a quality product in the end. Mm-hmm. So finding honey that you really like and is somewhere in that floral, fruity, confectionery, caramel, all the way up to malt and molasses flavor profile, right? That's like step number one. If you start with a honey that doesn't really taste that good, the mead you're going to make out of it, it's not going to taste that good.
So can you generally get that honey from like a supermarket, like Albertsons, Vaughn's, or do you have to go to a local farmer's market?
It's possible to get it from Albertsons, Vaughn's. There was one study that said that like 7 out of 10 honeys on the grocery store shelves are actually corn syrup doctored. So something to be aware of. You can send in samples and get them tested, but the best way to avoid that is to know your honey supplier, be able to ask them questions, ask them if they're big enough, if they have test data, and if they're small, where they keep their hives, how many hives they have, what honey came from where. And pretty soon you can tell the people who are very serious and passionate from those who are buying honey somewhere else and then reselling it, which is a thing that sadly does happen in our local markets sometimes. But then they'll typically let you sample things. So you're looking for a really full flavor profile that is outside of the kind of just generally sweet flavor profile, right? If they're marketing it as a varietal honey, it should have these varietal characteristics, like orange blossom should be citrusy, and jasmine-y, buckwheat should be rich and caramel with like a base note of almost like tannins. There's a number of varietal honeys with varietal honey descriptors, and beekeepers who are paying attention and doing a good job will be able to tell you, oh yeah, we kept these hives out in this part of the state or countryside, and then they were gathering this kind of nectar and it turned into this kind of honey and taste it, and then compare it to this honey, which was gathered here, and this honey, which was gathered there. And pretty soon you can tell the ones who are serious and know their stuff from the ones that are just buying honey from elsewhere and calling it generic.
That makes sense. So just ask some questions if you're at a farmer's market and someone's there to answer them.
And National Honey Board also has a website with a honey locator, and they do partner with reputable beekeepers who are doing a good job. So if you're looking for a supplier that way, that's also a resource.
Do they like link you to different websites to buy it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. Honey Locator is the part of their site where you can find honey through the National Honey Board.
And then just buy it and it gets shipped to you essentially?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay. So that covers honey for the most part. When it comes to like getting good yeast, are there any websites or brands that you would send people to?
So good yeast is critically important. And honestly, morebeer.com is like the clearinghouse. Your local homebrew store is probably legit. You do want to check expiration codes because sometimes rate of sale is slower than intended. And so you might get some yeast that are going out of date, but sometimes the homebrew stores are stoked to sell it to you. And if they're going out of date, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad. You just might want to get two of them, and the homebrew store might be stoked to give them to you for a big discount.
Oh, okay, cool. That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can probably get nutrients too at the same.
Nutrients are a little tricky because like homebrew stores don't nerd out on nutrients, right? Because they're typically selling to beer brewers, and beer brewers don't care about nutrients as much as us mead makers do.
Gotcha.
So they do typically stock nutrient, but sometimes it's hard to talk with them about it and exactly which nutrient's best suited for what you're going after. If you're starting with a dry yeast, you need two nutrients. You need the rehydration nutrient and the general fermentation nutrient.
Okay.
And then amongst your general fermentation nutrients, there's the organic nutrient option and then the inorganic nutrient option, or a blend of the two.
Which is DAP and Ferm-K?
So DAP is the inorganic ammonia-based nitrogen.
Okay.
And that is kind of intense and can be potentially damaging to the yeast over the long run. Fermate O is the organic version, and then Fermate K is a blend of the two.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But Fermate O and Fermate K are two versions of the general spectrum nutrient, and there's other producers who make a general spectrum nutrient. And typically they're pretty much the same. For home brewers' purposes, you want to experiment with a few to see which one works best and makes your yeast happiest. And then once you find it, stick with it. But when you're getting started out, based off what's available in your area and how nitpicky you want to be about your ingredients, then you're going to specialize, you're going to focus on a certain nutrient, and you're going to learn how to work with it to make it consistently good.
And what about yeast hydration nutrients?
Yeah, so yeast hydration nutrients are really important if you're using a dry yeast. It's what helps you wake the yeast back up in an environment where they're like, oh, this is safe to reproduce and turn out sugar into alcohol. If you don't give it to them, they're going to wake back up, but they're not going to be like ready to go right off the bat. And it's going to take a little bit for them to get through the lag phase and into the fermentation phase.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you use the nutrient, it's like 24 hours. The rehydration nutrient is typically like 24 hours they're up and they're fermenting.
Yeah.
And which is a key piece to a successful homebrew, is like you want a healthy, vigorous fermentation that's not too hot, but is consistent and vigorous. Otherwise, there's a risk of other organisms getting in there and spoiling your mead.
Are there like general yeast hydration nutrients that you recommend, or is it just whatever's local?
So GoFerm is our go-to fermentation rehydration nutrient, and it's made by Lallemand, and we get it through Scott Labs in pretty big quantities. Pretty sure that morebeer.com sells it in reasonable homebrew sizes.
Okay. But there are other ones out there?
There are. And we've just settled on Gopherm because it's solid.
Gotcha. Okay. And then when it comes to, like, what do you brew in? Do you have something that you feel like you recommend homebrewers brew in? Like, I've seen glass and plastic talked about, buckets versus carboys. Does it matter? What are your opinions on, like, your brew vessel?
Oh, man. So my personal preference is glass carboys.
Okay.
But if you've got the money to spend on a stainless steel jacketed or otherwise temp controlled vessel, I'd prefer that. I know a lot of people who have great success with plastic buckets. I just don't like to brew in plastic.
Gotcha.
So if you're going with glass, temp control is an important issue, like we've talked about a lot on the podcast. But if you can put your carboy in some kind of temp control environment, like a closet that is cool and stable in temperature, or a basement that's cool and stable in temperature, or I've even known people who have, like, put their carboys in a big metal dish filled with water wrapped in a shirt, so the shirt sucks the water up and creates evaporative cooling.
Whoa.
And okay, that's like a cheap way to, like, keep temp down. Okay. And they'll just buy, like, one of those little fish tank thermometers, like the sticky thermometers, and stick it on their carboy to make sure that they're staying within that temp. I've known people who put in an office that they can keep air conditioned, and that's a way to create temp control. What else? If you're using buckets and carboys, there are, like, neoprene jackets that have, like, a cooling line. Okay. And then you can buy a small cooler, which are going to cost, like, well, there's a couple different options. You can buy the, like, $1,000 Micromatic cooler, okay, which has a compressor, and you use glycol, and it runs the glycol through the lines. And then through the neoprene jacket, there's lines that allow that cooling liquid to circulate around the vessel and cool it down that way. Or you can, like, rig one up using ice and an ice chest.
Oh, okay.
And a heat exchanger with, like, a small little fish pump. So then the liquid in the lines off the ice chest go through these coils that go into the ice bath and then cool down the liquid in the coils and then out to the fermentation tank. So it's like a cheap glycol chiller using ice to cool things down.
Do you have to keep, like, refilling it with ice every once in a while, probably?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like, every couple of days.
Yeah.
But, you know, these are all options. And then you can get a chest freezer and put a Ranco temp controller on it and set that Ranco temp controller so that when the temp reaches the desired fermentation temp, the chest freezer turns off. And then when it rises above that, it turns on. And so you use the chest freezer as your fermentation chamber.
You just kind of know how to wire that, probably.
Right, which is pretty basic. There's a ton of videos on YouTube of how to wire a Ranco temp controller and solenoid valve setup.
Okay, so...
Or no, I wouldn't even need a solenoid valve for a chest freezer. You just need to wire it to the on and off switch of the power supply of the chest freezer.
Yeah, it would just be a couple of screws, right? Yeah, you'd have to take it off and put it into the Ranco.
Yeah.
Okay, so temp control is still important, even if you're using a carboy or a bucket.
Yes.
And you should probably refer to your yeast packet to know what temp you're shooting for.
That's right.
Are there any...
Better yet, are the actual tech specs of the yeast manufacturer, because the packet only has so much information, but usually the yeast producer has a website that has a PDF that you can download about this yeast, which includes how much nitrogen it needs, what its ideal temp range is, and then other stuff like how easily it flocculates, which means it falls out of solution and leaves you a clear mead, or attenuation rates aren't that relevant. Whether it's a big SO2 producer or not, sulfur dioxide, which is like the rotten egg smell. And then if you know that this is, then you're going to be able to be on the lookout for it and intervene before it gets really bad and is unsolvable.
Gotcha. So if you go directly to like the yeast producer's website, you just get way more information than whoever you bought it from, generally speaking?
So typically, and a little bit of packaging that it comes with.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. And then hydrometers are pretty important.
Very important.
And essentially, how do we describe a hydrometer?
Yeah, it's
using words.
It's a tool that allows you to measure the density of a liquid.
Yeah.
So it's like a glass tube with a smaller glass tube sticking off of it, and then it has wax and metal beads inside the bigger glass tube. And this has been built and measured to ensure that the smaller glass tube that extends off of the bigger glass tube has this graduated indicator bar on it. And so when you suspend that hydrometer in a tube full of mead, it'll find the density of the liquid. So it'll float to a certain level, and then where the mead mark, the water mark, is on the upper cylinder of the hydrometer, it'll show you a reading that either in specific gravity or bricks indicates how dense the liquid that you're measuring is. With specific gravity, that's relative to water.
Mm-hmm.
And with bricks, it's percent of dissolved sugar.
Gotcha. And that's important because it sets up your fermentation and it allows you to know how much like starting sugar essentially you have in your brew and how much alcohol you'll end up with.
And depending on what kind of yeast you use.
Yeah, and it allows you to track your brew in the sense that it is fermenting if you check it like daily, and you kind of know what is happening within your brew essentially.
It allows you to measure the rate of change of sugar and then extrapolate alcohol from that. So you start, if you do a 1:4 honey to water ratio, you're typically going to hit like 22 to 24% residual sugar bricks, 22 bricks, or like 11, 10, so 1.110 specific gravity, which means it's 1.110 times more dense than water.
Gotcha.
And over the course, depending on your yeast, some yeasts won't be able to ferment all that sugar because they'll die at like 6 or 8% alcohol. Some yeasts, like wine yeast and champagne yeast, will be able to ferment that and then some. So in the right conditions, they'll be able to eat all the sugar and turn it all into alcohol, and you'll get like a 12 to 13% ABV mead with very little sweetness, if any.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of your decision-making process, is what kind of yeast and what kind of sweetness do I want to end up with? What alcohol amount do I want to end up with? And therefore, what yeast is going to allow me to achieve both of those goals while also influencing the character, the flavor characteristics of this mead?
That makes sense. And like, what are some good resources online to get like good ratios if you want to figure out, like you said, a 1:4 ratio and I have this much honey? What are the websites you would use?
So the Mead Maker, Batch Builder, Calculator is really great because it allows you to dial in the volume of mead that you want to create. And then what your yeast's ABV tolerance is, and then how much residual sugar you want at the end, which is in specific gravity, which is annoying because in winemaking we're supposed to use bricks, but that's fine. And then nutrient requirement. Some yeasts have bigger nutrient requirements than others, and it lets you kind of toggle between them. And then if you want to use just only organic you nutrient regime, you click Fermade O. If you want to do a combination of Fermade K and DAP, or Fermade K, Fermade O, and DAP, you can figure all that out. But it'll basically spit out what volume of honey you need, what amount of yeast you need, what kind of nutrient you need, and when to add it. So that's a super valuable tool. Mead Maker, MAKR.com. And then Batch Builder is the link you go to in the toolbox.
Cool.
Yeah.
So it's all right there for you. You don't have to do a lot of math.
Not anymore, man. Different than when we started out, that's for sure.
Did you have like an Excel sheet?
Oh God. We had so many iterations of figuring it out, like mostly pen and paper, but yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah.
All right. I think the last thing I want to cover before we get into fermentation is like cleaning and sanitation and just the act of yeast rehydration before you stir everything together. Talk us through what's important there and how you'd go about doing that at home.
Yeah, yeast rehydration is key, and sanitation and cleanliness are key. So glad you brought them up. Cleanliness means removing all solid material from the surfaces that will touch the mead. Mm-hmm. Because if you have some solid, you know, deposits on your mead making tools or your vessels, then there's a good chance that microorganisms are living in there. And that when they're exposed to this liquid that is full of sugar and nutrient, they're going to be like, sweet, we can have all the babies we want. And then those babies are going to get in there into the mead, and they're going to make all kinds of nasty flavors that ruin your meat. Mm-hmm. So cleaning your vessels and your tools is critical. And cleaning removes like 99% of microorganisms, right? But then sanitizing is the next step, and that will take it from 99 to like 99.9999, like base log six. If you use an iodine spray or a Star San, which is a potassium-based food grade sanitizer, or, you know, there's a number of different food grade sanitizers out there, mm-hmm. that don't require a rinse after you use them, but they will reduce the viable microorganisms on a surface to like one out of a million.
Yeah.
Which means they're going to have a much harder time reproducing.
Yeah.
Than if it's like one out of 100. Mm-hmm. So one out of a million means that there's a much better chance that your meat's going to come out clean on the back end, and you're going to avoid microbial spoilage, which, yeah, we'll talk about in a little bit. Mm-hmm. So then after you've got clean equipment and clean fermentation vessel, you need healthy yeast. Because if you throw unhealthy yeast into your mead, there's a chance that the organisms that are present in the honey will take over.
Gotcha.
And they'll make your mead funky. Because there's all kinds of wild yeast dormant in honey. The sugar, the osmotic pressure from the high amount of sugar and the low amount of water suppresses the wild yeasts and bacteria that are present in the honey. But once you water it down, there's a chance they come back to life, unless you have a very large population of a fermentation yeast there to knock them out.
Gotcha.
So rehydrating your yeast to give them the best chance of reproducing and basically taking over the fermentation is critical. And that means that you've got to follow the manufacturer's instructions on rehydrating the yeast. Different ones specify different rehydration temperatures and volumes of water. But basically, you take water, you heat it up, you do a little bit of math to figure out how much water you need with a given amount of yeast. You heat that water up to a certain temp, you dissolve your fermentation, your rehydration nutrients into that warm water. You then let that water cool down, or you start with half of the amount of water at the temp that the yeast nutrient needs to dissolve, and then you water it down with cooler water to get it to the temp that the yeast want.
Because there's two different temps going on here. There's
dissolving
the yeast
temp.
Yeah, there's yeast nutrient optimal temp, and then there's the actual yeast optimal temp.
Right.
Yeah.
And the yeast nutrient dissolving temp is typically higher than the yeast optimal temp. Mm-hmm. So you start out with a smaller volume of warmer water. You dissolve the nutrients. You then water that down with cooler water to get the right amount of water volume at the right temp. And then you add the yeast. And the yeast wakes up within 5 to 10 to 15 minutes, depending on your manufacturer's recommendations. And it starts to like bubble and get kind of creamy, and that's when you know it's time to pitch the yeast. But you only do that after you've blended your honey and water together, which
which we should get to next.
We should talk about it. Yeah.
Now we're on the actual fermentation, and the start of that is adding honey and water together and blending it. Now, here at GCM, commercially, we use a motor.
Yeah.
To pump to blend the two.
Right.
Are there any certain ways you recommend home users doing it, or is it just a stir stick, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think a bucket at that phase and a funnel before you get into the carboy is very practical. You know, if you're doing 5 gallons, you need typically 1 gallon of honey and 4 gallons of water if you're going for like a 12 to 13% mead. So you take that 1 gallon of honey and you slowly pour it into the 5 gallon bucket that's filled with, say, 3 gallons of water, right? So you got plenty of room for stirring vigorously. And you just got a long metal spoon that's been cleaned and sanitized, and the bucket's been cleaned and sanitized, and the funnel's been cleaned and sanitized, but you'll need the funnel later. You pour the 1 gallon of honey slowly into the 3 gallons of water. Preferably the 3 gallons of water is at least room temp, 68 degrees. A little warmer helps because warmer water dissolves honey better.
Gotcha.
But you don't want it to be too warm to make the yeast stressed when they're getting started. And that would be like up to 80 degrees, you're pretty much safe. Like yeast typically are okay 75 to 80 the first 6 to 12 hours, and then hopefully it cools down to 68 degrees or room temperature, because that's typically the sweet spot for most yeasts. But if you're using a Scandinavian Kvike yeast, like, they like 90 degrees Fahrenheit to 100. And if you're using a champagne yeast, like, that thing can ferment down to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe even 45.
Wow.
So there's a big range. Yeah. Yeah.
But generally speaking,
room temp is solid for most yeasts. So you start a little higher than that with the water temp. You then stir the honey in until it's thoroughly dissolved. You don't want any layer of honey on the bottom of your bucket with your water. And you've got a pretty homogenized liquid. And then you add 1/4 of your yeast, of your yeast nutrient, of your over broad spectrum nutrient, whether it's fermented O or fermented K and fermented O or fermented K and fermented O and DAP or whatever you're going to do for your yeast nutrient. And we could talk about that if you wanted to, but that's kind of advanced. Like, for getting started, I recommend fermented O.
Okay.
It's going to be solid. You put 1/4 of it up front, and then the next 3 days you add 1/3 of the remaining amount of nutrient needed. And then by the end of day 3, you just kind of set it and let it ride.
Yeah.
So you've mixed your honey and water.
You've mixed your honey and water.
You've
added some nutrient. And then you want to throw in the yeast.
Mm-hmm. And the yeast at this point have been rehydrated. Or rather, you start the rehydration step when you're like at the end of the honey addition and nutrient addition steps. And you let the yeast basically wake back up over 10 to 15 minutes. And this is a good time to clean equipment that you're not going to use, or, you know, have a mead, whatever. And you wait that 5 to 15 minutes, depending on your manufacturer's specifications. And then you pour that yeast into that container. And it's important to aerate your mead when you're first getting started. So vigorous stirring with the metal spoon helps to aerate, but then also pouring the mead into the carboy through a funnel is going to aerate it a bit as well.
Gotcha. So your starting bucket, and once you're mixing the must, the water and the honey, so aerating that is good.
Splash, 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 as you stir.
Mm-hmm. As you stir the yeast you're adding, but also when you're pouring it back into the carboy, which is the fermentation vessel, you're also adding aeration into it,
mm-hmm.
which is good for it. You shouldn't worry about
at this point. Yeah. The first 3 days air is required. It is necessary to make healthy yeast that can ferment all the way to dryness, or like the higher end of the alcohol tolerance of that yeast.
That makes sense.
Because oxygen helps the yeast form lipids with nitrogen. Gotcha. And therefore have strong cell walls to exclude alcohol from poisoning them later on.
Gotcha. All right. So you added the yeast, you added the yeast nutrient, you aerated it, you pour it through the funnel. You're going to put an airlock up top. And then
that's been cleaned and sanitized.
That's been cleaned and sanitized.
And then filled with some kind of sanitary liquid.
Yeah.
So that as the CO2 gets produced in the carboy, the CO2 can come out through the airlock and no bugs or oxygen can get into the mead to spoil it.
Yeah. And I think the next couple of steps that are intertwined are aeration and staggered nutrient addition over the next couple of days.
Right.
Which are important mead. And how would you recommend homebrewers go about doing that?
So aeration at this point in a carboy, the easiest way to make this happen is to buy the like $25 aeration drill attachment. So you take your home battery drill or cord drill, whatever, and you can plug this foot and a half long metal stick that has these little plastic swirly thingies on the end that are like on a swivel.
Okay.
So when you spin the metal shaft, it makes the plastic fins go out and then whips up the mead. And you want to start slow, because it's going to degas the mead first. It's going to take all the CO2 that's in solution from the fermentation, and it's going to let that all off gas. But then you start to work it from the top to the bottom, and it starts to bring air into the liquid, which then makes that available for the yeast.
And can you get that from like a home brewing store or Home Depot?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's called an aeration shaft or aeration
stick
or okay. Drill attachment. Okay. And yeah,
it's probably the easiest way. Can people like shake it if they put the cap on?
Yeah, we totally have done that. I mean, you actually want the cap off because you want the air to get in there. So you like can swirl it gently at first to get the CO2 to come out. And then you start swirling it and sloshing it, and it starts to incorporate air in. If you want to get super intense, you can get a fish pump with a clean little bubbler.
Okay.
And you clean all that, sanitize it, and then put it in there, and then the fish pump will pump air into your mead.
Hmm. Okay. And then when it comes to staggering nutrients, would you do that like before you aerate or after you aerate?
Okay. Yeah, before, do it after aeration. If you do it before, then it's like Mentos and 7-Up, you know, rapid evacuation is the technical
mead
term.
Mead volcano.
Mead volcano is the less technical term, and it sucks. It's a sticky mess and all that beautiful potential mead is now wasted. So you need to always degas or stir before you add nutrient, and wait until the CO2 has come out of solution before you put the nutrient in.
Gotcha. So optimally, like the first couple of days after you start your brew, you go in, you're re-aerating it, you start slow, then you do that. Is there a time frame on that you would recommend, or just 5-10 minutes?
Yeah, 5 to 10 minutes, depending on how you're aerating. If you're sloshing, it's going to be more like 10 minutes. If you're drilling, it's going to be more like 5 minutes.
Gotcha. And then once that's all settled, you add some nutrients and then you cap it back up?
Roughly a third of the remaining over the next 3 days. Gotcha. So at like the 24-hour mark, the 48-hour mark, the 72-hour mark. But you do want to be taking hydrometer readings at each one of these points and making sure that you're not past the one-third sugar break. So that's where one-third of the total sugar have been consumed. So if you're at a 23% residual sugar when you start, then that's 6.9. So that is like 16.1% residual sugar. If you pass that point, then adding nutrient, there's a good chance that the yeast aren't going to assimilate it. Gotcha. And you're going to have a mead that tastes like Flintstone vitamins on the back end.
Okay.
And then if you're aerating after that point too, there's a good chance that the yeast aren't going to eat that oxygen and turn it into strong cell walls. So then you're going to get like oxidized mead that tastes like sherry a lot more easily.
Okay. So yeah, it's important to know where your Brix is at, but generally speaking, the first 3 days getting the nutrients and aeration done is important and beneficial to the brew.
Yeah. And if you're using a yeast that goes really fast or you're starting at a lower ABV, then putting more up front is appropriate. Like if you're only going to have 2 days to add your nutrient, then doing half of it the first day and the second half the second day is better than missing a third because you waited too long.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That makes sense. And I think a question that goes into this topic, too, is like a lot of people, how much headspace do you leave in the carboy or the bucket? Because if you fill it up all the way, aerating it's going to be hard and it might be easier for a mead volcano to happen. So,
yeah.
What's your thoughts on like the headspace to leave in there, I guess?
Yeah, you kind of want to start at like 80% of the volume that you're shooting for. So if you have a 5 gallon carboy and you're going for 5 gallons of mead, if you fill it up with 5 gallons of mead, you're going to have like no headspace. And then when the fermentation starts, it's going to bubble over and it's going to be a mess. And there's a very good chance of microbial contamination or infection. So what you want to do is withhold about 20% of your honey and 20% of your water, and mix about 80% of your water and 80% of your honey and fill it into your carboy. So it fills up the volume up to like, here's the neck of the carboy and then here's the shoulders of the carboy. You've got like a good inch and a half from the top of the shoulders of the carboy. It's kind of my optimal amount. Gotcha. If you get much above that, you're not going to have much room to swirl, not going to have much room to add nutrient and stir. And there's a good chance that as a vigorous fermentation happens, the bubbles are going to come out of the carboy.
Gotcha.
So like an inch and a half from the neck, the bottom of the neck and the top of the shoulder.
Gotcha. Okay. On a carboy.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes sense. So, but overall, if you're using a bucket and not a carboy, like 2 to 3 inches maybe of space.
I mean, 3 is even probably too much. I think 2 you can get away with, an inch and a half you can get away with. Okay. Less than that, it's going to be dicey. More than that, it's going to be kind of wasteful.
Okay, fair enough. And then I think what a lot of people worry about during fermentation are infections and their mead looking weird.
Yeah.
Weird stuff floating around.
Yeah.
Is there like an easy way to know that's an infection or that's normal, or you just got to look up pictures? What's your experience with that?
Yeah. So infection, one important point is that like alcoholic homemade beverages can't make you sick or kill you as long as it's over, I think, 1.5% alcohol. And then to be safe, you can just double that and say 3% alcohol, right? So if you get 0.55% alcohol for every 1% of sugar, and you started at 23% sugar, then once you're down to like 17% sugar, you're at 3% alcohol, even more than that, 3.15. So you're like, or 3.3. So you're like happy. You're like, I'm totally safe here. Like if you go down from 23 to 17, like you can drink whatever you end up getting. Now, does it taste good? And that's where microbial spoilage or infection can kind of be a concern. So sometimes a layer of mold can develop on top of the yeast, and like that often leads to mead vinegar because acetobacter gets in there. So if there's like a film of white kind of dust on the top, it's like that's a mold. If they're
is
like,
it like see-through, or would you not be able to see the mead?
The mead is see-through.
The mold though?
The mold is like an opaque white.
Opaque white.
Okay. Yeah.
Would it be in clumps on the top, or would it cover kind of the whole thing?
My experience has been like covering the whole thing, but sometimes a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast can happen, which is like the loogies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's gross. You don't want those.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're trying to make like a jun or a kombucha and you're down for things tasting weird, because that's like when Brettanomyces and Pediococcus and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is the typical alcoholic fermentation yeast, they all get together and like make these long gelatinous things that persist. But anyways, if there's like gooey stuff on the top, if there's black stuff, if there's anything that looks like mold, I mean, sometimes what you get is the nutrient and the proteins in the honey from like the wax and other stuff, they kind of coagulate into this like brown foam residue.
Okay.
And typically that's okay.
Okay.
Like if that happens, it's not so much to worry about.
Gotcha. So
but
brown foam residue is okay.
Typically, if it starts to turn black or smell bad, then that's not okay. But hopefully you've done your job cleaning and the yeast is the preeminent organism. So if the foam residue has gotten everywhere inside the carboy and then died down, it's still like dead yeast that you want there. It's not mold and bacteria that are going to create off flavors and spoil your meat.
Are there any other common things that look weird from your experience but are okay?
No, you typically want the liquid to be like a uniform color.
Okay.
You want to see bubbles coming up. You want to smell a like pleasant alcohol-y smell when you gently put your nose up to the neck of the carboy above the airlock and give it a sniff. If you start to get bad smells out of that, that's not always a good sign. Actually, it's like a pretty bad sign, and you might want to look into what that smell specifically smells like, and therefore what it indicates is going wrong, and therefore what corrective action you can take at this point, because it is typically easier to correct during fermentation than after. Easier during fermentation than after.
Are there any resources that like have all that information? Like, can you Google, this is happening in my mead, here's what you do?
Yeah, Modern Mead Makers has a really good like FAQ resource. So that's a Facebook group that has like 40,000 members and it's very active. So often people post that up there, like kind of basic questions, but if they just read the FAQ, all the answers would be there for the most part.
Gotcha.
And then it directs you like, okay, if your answers aren't answered here, this is how you ask the questions so that people can give you helpful advice.
Gotcha. Okay. And so is there anything else you want to mention about fermentation at home that we haven't really covered, or you kind of want to move to post-fermentation?
Light is an issue, right? Okay. You want to ferment in a dark, cool temperature, stable place.
Gotcha.
Light can definitely mess up yeast. So you don't want it like happening in the middle of a room.
Yeah. Most people do it in a basement or a closet, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We've mixed the honey, we've mixed the water, water chemistry. We didn't talk about water chemistry, and there's some basic stuff. Like, don't use tap water because it has chlorine in it, typically, and chlorine will kill your yeast. So well water that's like of decent to high quality is good, or buy spring water at the store. You can also do reverse osmosis water that's been back treated to have some tasty water chemistry, and that will change your meat. Like, meat is 85% water, right? So what kind of water you use matters, and the better tasting the water is, the more likely your meat's going to turn out tasting well.
That makes sense. And it's probably easiest to go just buy spring water from the store than if you don't have access to a filter.
Not just a filter, but a reverse osmosis, because a carbon filter isn't going to remove the chlorine, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's going to make it taste a little bit different, but it's not going to actually remove this chemical that kills microorganisms, and therefore it will stress out your yeast and make it harder to succeed.
Yeah, you're just setting your yeast up for failure.
Exactly. If you don't use good water, you're setting your yeast up for failure.
That makes sense.
So we talked about water. Yeast, you want to make sure it's before its expiration date. We've got rehydration nutrient. We've got broad spectrum nutrient. We've got temp control. We've got aeration. We've got the volumes. Oh, using the hydrometer. So not only do you want a hydrometer, you want to use it to measure your initial starting gravity or Brix, so that you know how much sweetness was in the honey water mixture, which is called a must, before you ferment it. And then that gives you a sense of the potential alcohol. You multiply that number, if it's Brix, by 0.55, and you get the percent of, so 23 times 0.55, if you're at 23 Brix when you start, and you multiply it by 0.55% alcohol per percent honey or percent sugar, then you result in something like 12.5% ABV.
And that's also how you kind of make the call on when to end your fermentation too, is you know how much alcohol you're shooting for, so you know what level you want to get the hydrometer to before you start to stabilize it, essentially.
Exactly. Which you could put it in your cold box and that would slow it down, or you can use these fining agents, which we'll talk about, or you could use preservatives that also kill the yeast.
So we've taken the mead down to whatever ABV we want, say, let's say 2 bricks or whatever it is you want.
You kind of conflate bricks and ABV there. Which one are you talking about?
Well,
they're related.
You take it, you take your mead down to the alcohol content you want.
Okay.
Which
23 down to 2 means you've fermented 21, which times 0.55 is 11.5.
11.5. So you take it down to 1 bricks for 12.5.
Yeah.
So it hits 1 bricks. 12.
Yeah.
And you want to stop it.
Okay.
What do you do next?
Ideally, you can put it in your cold box. And that's like the way to get the yeast to go. We were having a party and then it got cold. We quit. We're going to sleep. And they start to drop out of solution. They start to literally fall down to the bottom of the fermentation vessel. You can add a chemical like potassium sorbate. We don't do that here at Golden Coast Mead, but it will arrest the fermentation. You can add a fining agent, which is going to go into the mead and it's going to grab the yeast based off of the charge of the fining agent, typically. Sometimes there's a mechanical aspect, but typically you like sprinkle a dust that's been diluted in water into the mead, and that dust has a charge. Those dust particles have a charge to it, which then attracts the yeast to them and then grabs them into clumps and pulls them to the bottom.
Gotcha. Now, do all fining agents just clear out yeast, or do they do more than that?
No, there are some fining agents that include enzymes that break down proteins that can prevent clarity. But for the most part, you're trying to figure out how to get the yeast out of solution.
Gotcha. And when it comes to like cold crashing it, how long does it usually take for the yeast to drop down to the bottom?
Depends on the honey that you've used and how many proteins are in it, colloidal proteins. And then also the yeast's flocculation characteristics. So sometimes a certain honey and a certain yeast can take a long time to clarify, even with a clarifying agent. Sometimes it can happen really quickly within 2 to 3 days.
Gotcha.
So
it's just hard to generalize.
It's really hard to generalize because we're not even sure which colloidal proteins causes the haze problem and how to identify them up front. It's kind of like the same varietal of honey can vary year to year and be either easier to clarify or harder to clarify for some weird reason.
So it's like there's science still to be figured out.
A lot of science to be figured out, yeah.
And are there any like fining agents you recommend or that you would want home users to use instead of others?
You know, bentonite is like the vegan vegetarian one. It's just made of clay. So it's, I think it's positively charged. So it's, we've had decent success with bentonite. We use sparkoloid where it's like diatomaceous earth. And then we dissolve that in hot water. And then we pour that into the mead and it does a better job than bentonite in my experience, but some people are happy with bentonite. And then there's isinglass, which is fish bladders. We don't use that one. There's another one, I think it's called chitosan or something, and that's like horse hooves. We don't use that one. There's Irish moss. We don't use that one.
Have you ever used any of those?
We experimented with Irish moss. We never wanted to get into isinglass because we didn't want to use fish bladders in our mead, and we didn't experiment with chitosan because we didn't want to use, you know, horse hooves.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm wrong on that, please correct me. But that's my understanding is that that's what they're made of. We used Irish moss once and it was not as effective as sparkoloid.
Gotcha. So the most effective in your experience is just sparkoloid.
Yeah. And that is made from minuscule shellfish. The shells of the dead shells. So it's like made from seashells, basically.
Gotcha. Okay. That's fair. And then I think a lot of people like to know about back sweetening. And I know just from personally, you don't like back sweetening.
Nope.
But like, if we could do some pros and cons to it, I guess.
Sure. So some people like back sweetening because it's like, okay, my fermentation finished and it's kind of high in alcohol and kind of dry. I'm going to add some honey to it and that's going to make it sweeter and it's still a mead. And it accomplishes an end of having a sweeter mead in a pretty straightforward kind of process. Mm-hmm. The downside of my end is that there's no integration between the honey note and the fermented mead note. Okay. It's like taking wine and being like, this is too dry, and then adding grape juice. It's like two totally different things with no bridge between them.
Gotcha.
So I've tasted some of these meads sometimes, and it's like, am I tasting diluted honey? Like, I get a little bit of mead character, but it's mostly just diluted honey character. Mm. And it's not that interesting or balanced or complex.
So it kind of just takes you out of the beverage.
Yeah. It's like, okay, we're drinking a diluted honey drink instead of like a mead, which is like synthesized to be the best aspects of the honey.
So let me ask this.
Okay.
Is there a back sweetening mead you've tasted that you're like, oh, this added to the mead rather than it took away from it?
Not that comes to mind. I mean, okay. The sweet meads that I've had that are good are where they just start with a ton of honey up front, and then that gets turned into whatever alcohol target they're going for. And it's engineered so that that residual sugar that remains plus that alcohol balance each other out and make a mead stool that's really interesting and compelling.
And you'd even recommend that if you're adding fruit to a mead, like to make a mellow mill, you would approach it from that space rather than like back sweetening a mead with blueberries or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think back sweetening with fruit is a little different than back sweetening with honey, because there is sugar in the fruit, but you're also going to extract tannin and you're going to extract acid, and the alcohol is going to help you do that.
Okay.
So there's a different complexity, and it's not just one note of sweetness on a finished mead.
Gotcha.
It's like acid, tannin, and fruit and sweetness all integrated together.
Okay.
So
you're more okay with back sweetening with different types of fruits. It's a high no when it's your back sweetening with honey.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
From my experience, I'm open to being mind blown.
And does it destabilize the mead?
Totally. It totally can. Yeah. So pH and alcohol, if you're not using a chemical stabilizer, are your two major stabilizing aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And a pH under 3 is going to be really solid, and an alcohol over 14 is going to be really solid. But acid under 3 is like, whoa, that's acidic. Like,
yeah.
It's going to make your teeth kind of grind together in
it's gritty.
A gritty way. Yeah. So we typically end up at like 3.4% pH and then like 12% ABV. And we found that in most cases, that is a pretty stable combo. But there are cases where re-fermentation does happen. Mm-hmm. So we're in containers that are relatively safe for that.
Yeah.
And that's how we deal with that risk. But I would say each meadery is going to, and each mead maker is going to figure out their own stabilization regime that allows them to get the closest that they can to their ideal mead.
Yeah, that makes sense. But those essentially are tools you have. You can make the mead colder. You can use fining agents. You can filter.
Right. Yeah, we haven't even talked about filtering because it's not that appropriate for home
scale.
Like, that's advanced home brewing if you're going to buy a filter. But if you do a proper job of fining and then racking, we haven't talked about racking,
that's
right?
True.
That's the process of transferring from the primary fermentation vessel to another vessel. And that leaves behind a ton of yeast that's created like a layer of sediment
at the bottom.
And will change the flavor over time. That layer of sediment with all that yeast will decay and dissolve into the mead. And depending on whether that yeast was happy and good tasting, or if it was stressed and bad tasting, that's going to have a major impact on the mead that it's aging upon. So surly aging, where you leave the mead on the lees, on the yeast cake, is one way of doing it, versus racking, transferring the mead from the primary fermentation vessel into a clean, sanitized secondary fermentation vessel and letting it clarify further. and then either bottling from secondary or doing another racking and bottling it from a tertiary container.
So, but I think that's a good start for a home brewer, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've walked through everything from choosing your honey and water to mixing your honey and water, adding your yeast, doing your nutrient profile for both the yeast rehydration and the broad spectrum, doing aeration, doing temp control, then monitoring fermentation with the hydrometer.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get into like course reactions if something goes off during the fermentation, but that is more advanced.
Yeah.
At this point, it's kind of like a good start is hopefully all you need to have a good finish. Then you get it through fermentation where you're down to that 2% residual sugar, 1% or less residual sugar. And then you are fining to clarify, and then you are racking, and then you are potentially ready to bottle.
Yeah.
And you can test pH with a pH strip. And as long as it's under 3.4, I think it's relatively safe. 3.2 to 3.3 is more ideal in my mind.
Yeah. But it just starts to get grittier.
Yep. When you're under three, it's like your teeth are bouncing when they rub on each other.
Is there any home recipes you would recommend for someone?
Home recipes. You know, I'm a purist in terms of varietal honey, a yeast that matches the characteristics of that honey and promises to accentuate them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a floral fruity honey, having kind of a white wine yeast that's going to accentuate floral fruity characteristics, or if you have a malty caramely, having more of a beer yeast that's going to complement those beer-like characteristics. That's my general approach because I'm really interested in drinking alcohol made from honey and not, you know, additional things. That being said, there are some crowd pleasers like a lemon ginger mead. And there's a bunch of recipes. Gotmead.com has a bunch of recipes. If you just Google lemon ginger mead recipe, you know, award-winning lemon ginger mead recipe. I'm always a fan of those. I think they convert people very easily. Berry meads are very popular, you know, raspberries, blackberries, boysenberries. Like if you can come up with those fruits and then manage that fermentation, that can be a really beautiful mead. Then there's some just spice and herbs and secondary, which is a really cool way to do it. Within 24 to 36 hours, maybe 48, you can take a 5-gallon batch, break it down into 1-gallon batches, and then take those 1-gallon batches and break them down into 500 milliliter glass ball jars. And then you just do like, you know, a teaspoon of one spice and a half teaspoon of another stronger spice. And you soak them in the mead for 24 to 36 hours. And then you have like a totally different flavor experience. And if you want to make more of it, you can just make, you know, scale it up to 1 gallon or scale it up to 5 gallons. The rule of thumb there is always start with less than you think you need, because you can always add more. You can't take it away.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge.
Oh man, my pleasure, Brando. All right, listeners, we got a challenge for you.
Luise, make mead and send it to us.
Ah, make mead, any kind. Hopefully it's drinkable. If not, we will put you on the wall of shame. No, maybe. And if it's amazing, we'll put you on the wall of fame. And your homemade making will go down in history via our social media and website.
Can't wait to try it.
Yeah, send it to Golden Coast Mead, 4089 Oceanside Boulevard, Suite H, Oceanside, California, 92056. Make sure you follow all local laws and ordinances. We disclaim all responsibility for your legal compliance. All right, thanks. Bring us your mead via UPS and FedEx.
All right, that's a wrap on Brewing Mead at Home. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there's anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at podcast@goldencoastmead.com with your questions, and we'll try to answer them to the best of our ability for you. Now here's the weekly bee joke. What do you call a wasp? A wannabe. Mead out.